The 10th parak of Babat Basra deals primarily with the halachas of the documents. What is required to have a valid document? Who hires the sofer? Who has to pay the sofer? What if there are indiscrepancies inside the document itself? How do we understand the text of the language? The first Mishnah, just a little bit by way of background, there were two general types of shtaros. It's also called a get. Typically, we call a get as a divorce document, but in our Mishnah, and oftentimes in Mishnah, a get will simply mean a document, a shtar. There were two, on a high level, types of documents that were entered into in the time of the Mishnah. By the time of the Rishonim, this was no longer done. But at the time of the Mishnah, there was not only a normal, ordinary document called a get pashud, but also something highly unusual. It was called a get mikushar. A get mikushar was a document that was written in a way that they would write a line and then leave a blank line and fold it over on that area and sew it, and then they would refold again. They would write again and refold, and there were various folds in the document in order to slow down the process of writing the document. Originally, this was instituted by Chazal in order to slow down a Kohen who wanted to give a get of divorce to his wife. A Kohen is not permitted to remarry if he gives a get. So they wanted to slow down the process, make sure the Kohen is making an educated decision, not in the heat of the moment. And therefore, they required a get mikushar, the slow accordion-looking-like document that had a minimum of three folds in it, in order to permit the Kohen to enter into a divorce. Now, that was somewhat adopted for other types of shtaros, other types of documents, but for other types of documents, you had an option to have either a regular document, a simple document, a get pashut, or a get mikushar. So get pashut is the name of our parak, and it starts as follows. Mishnah Aleph, get pashut, edav mitocho. When you have a simple document, the edim, those who are signing onto the document as witnesses, they would sign as a normal document on the face of the document itself. Mekushar edav me'achorav. However, if we have the type of get mekushar that was folded over, a minimum of three edim would have to sign on the back, on the folds. Pashut shekasvu edav me'achorav. And if they reverse this, and in other words, if you have a get pashut, and unfortunately the edim signed on the back, not on the face of the document itself, or conversely, umekushar shekasvu edav mitocho, or if you have a get mekushar, the accordion-like folded type of shtar, and the Edim signed on the inside, Shneim Psulim, these are both possible because the Edim have not signed in the right place. Rabbi Hanina ben Gamliel Omer, he disagrees on one point. He says, if you have a Mekushar, Shekasu Edav Mitocho Kasher. If you have the Get Mekushar, the folded Get, the folded document, and it's Edim signed on the inside, that is going to be kosher. Why? Mipnei she'yachol la'asoso pashut. Because you can simply unfold it and make it a normal document. And if it's a normal document, even though there's some additional space between the lines for where the folds were, that doesn't matter. It would be a kosher, simple document with the signatures in the proper place. So that would be acceptable. The next step in the Gemara talks about if somebody hires a sofer who with a scribe to write a get, and he gave him instructions. I would like a get pashut, and the sofer didn't follow the instructions and did a get mekushar. Or conversely, the person requested a get mekushar, and the sofer wrote up a simple document, a get pashut. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, in this situation, although the majority view is this is a problem because you have instructed the sofer and he has done otherwise. But Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says in a specific situation, Akol Kemina Kamedina, if we are in a Medina, if we are in a locale, well, they would use both types of gittin. They would use documents that were the simple type and also the types of shtaros that were the mekushar, were the folded types, and you instructed your scribe, your sofer, one way, and he did another way. Because both types are used in that vicinity, it would not be a problem. It would still be a valid document. We assume that the person was simply instructing the sofer to do one way because it was his preference, but not that it really mattered too much to the person who was having the document written. In Mishnah Beis, the Mishnah starts off with the discussion of a second difference between the Get Pashut and the Get Mekusher. In the prior Mishnah, we saw that a fundamental difference is where do the Eidim sign for a Get Pashut, a simple document, the Eidim sign on the inside, and a Get Mekusher, the folded Get, they would sign on the outside. Our Mishnah says as follows, Get Pashut, Eidav Bishnaim, when you have a simple document, a normal document, it only requires two witnesses. Mekusher, however, if you have a Get Mekusher, the folded, it requires Bishlosh, it requires three witnesses. And then the Mishnah further clarifies that. Pashut Shekasu Bo Eidechad, if you have a simple document, a get Pashut, a star, a document that only has one witness signed on the inside of it, on the face of the document, umekushar shikasu bo shnei edim, and you have a mekushar, and they signed in the right place on the outside, but it was only two witnesses, not three witnesses, shnehem psulim, both of those documents are pasul, because a get pashut requires two edim, and a get mekushar requires three edim. The Seifa of the Mishnah starts an interesting discussion of how we analyze a contract, if, for example, there's a contradiction internally, or if there's a word missing and the like. So the Mishnah says as follows, Kasav bo, if the star, if the document says internally, for example, a loan document, and the borrower is saying to the lender, I owe you X amount of dollars, but it's contradictory in how it's written, how much is actually owed, Zuzin mea. De'inun sil'in esrin, I owe you 100 zuz, which is equal to 20 sela. The example would be, and it's really not worth 20 sela, an example to this would be, I owe you a dollar, which is 3/4. It's not 3/4, it's 4/4. So the example here is that it says it's 100 zuz, which is 20 sela, and it's really worth 25 sela. Ein lo ela esrin, the malve, the person who's owed the money, can only collect the lower amount, can only collect the 20 sela, but cannot collect the 25 sela, which is really equal to the 100 zuz. What's the concept here? So you can't collect more than you have a proof for, and if you don't have a proof, hamotzi mechaviro alav haraya, you need to bring a proof. So if you don't have a proof, then you can only collect the lower amount. And similarly, zuzin, if the contract says as follows, another contradiction internally, zuzin mea, I owe you 100 zuz, de'inun, which are klasin silin, which are equal to 30 sela, and we know it's only worth 25 sela. So here too also, ein lo ela maneh, here he could also only collect the lower amount, which would be the maneh, which is the 100 zuz. Our next discussion in the Mishnah deals with a case where there is a word missing from the document. It got erased. They didn't used to have the fancy Bic pens that we have nowadays with the same quality, and letters would flake off. So here, unfortunately, what flaked off was the amount that was owed. Ksaf zuzin de'inun. It says specifically, I owe you silver zuzim, which are, and then the balance, the amount owed, v'nimchak, was erased. So how much can the malveh, the lender, collect based on that document in Pachos Mishtaim, because when it says zuzin, zuzin is in the plural tense, so he can collect two zuz and no law more, because he can collect without a raya, without a proof. Hamotzi mechaviro alav haraya. And we're going to have another two examples of the same concept here, but it's going to be in different amounts of money. Besaf silin de'inun. So it's here in this case, it's an amount of silin, a different type of currency, de'inun, and in the amount of v'nimchak, and the amount is erased. Again, in pachos mishtayim, you can only collect two because it said silin in plural. Darkonos, this is a gold coin, even more expensive. De'inun, I owe you back gold coins in the amount of, and v'nimchak, and the amount was erased. In pachos mishtayim, you can only collect two, no more than that, without having a proof that he had lent more. The Mishnah now continues, what happens if we have an internal contradiction in the document in two different places? Before, we had a contradiction when it was written together, the amount together, it was internally contradictory, but it was right after the other. Here we have an example of where it says a sum that was owed at the top of the star, at the top of the document, and a different amount that is listed at the bottom of the document. Which do we go by? So it says as follows, Kasuv bo milamala maneh, says at the beginning of the shtar, above, that a maneh is owed, that's 100, umilamata matayim, and below it says 200. What do we go by? Do we go with the above amount or the below amount? So before we said you can only collect the lower amounts. In this case, it's different because they are written in different places in the document. We are actually going to go by the later amount. So similarly, milamala ma'asayim umilamata maneh. And even if the converse, above it says 200, below it says 100, hakol holech achar atachton, regardless of it being a higher amount or lower amount beneath, we are going to go after the second recorded amount. The concept here is that because we assume that the sofer made a mistake at the beginning, or maybe there was a change of mind at the amount that would be lent or something like that, so we assume that the lower amount is the accurate amount, and that's what we'll be bearing between the parties. So then the Mishnah asks, so if we're always going to go by the second number, why do you have to write it twice? Why write it at the beginning? In Kain Lama Kosvinesa Elyon. Why do you write the first amount? Just write it once towards the bottom. So the Mishnah says, Shim Timachek Os Achas Minatachton, because if a letter below flakes off and we can't read it, we want to have a second opinion, Yilmad Mina Elyon. If we need to refer to the upper amount to fill in that letter to know what it says, we can then look at the and assume that it's accurate above, but otherwise the default would be that we're going to use the lower number. In other words, not the lower number by amount, but the lower number meaning the second number that's recorded in the document. Mishnah Gimel and thereafter Mishnah Dalet deal with when two parties are having a contract drawn up, or if there's a get that's being entered into, which of the two parties have to request from the sofer that he draft that document, and in addition, which of them has to pay for the sofer's fees. Today we would call it legal fees, but back then the legal fee was paid to the sofer who was the scribe writing the legal document. So the Mishnah, our Mishnah, Mishnah Gimel, will talk about three different scenarios. Number one is a get that is being drafted by the sofer. Number two is a loan document, and number three is a bill of sale. The Mishnah says as follows, Kosvin get la'ish, Af al pishen ishto imo. The husband can be there. He can request the sofer to draft a get to divorce his wife. He would go get the divorce. It would be written, signed by the witnesses, and then the husband would then go and deliver it to the wife. V'hashover le'isha. And in addition, this is a related issue that the shover would be written for the isha. So in contrast to the get itself, that the man has to request it and be present with the sofer and the edim, here the shover is a document that evidences a receipt of the payment for her ksuba. And when she would receive the payment of the ksuba, she would give the shover, the receipt, to the husband, who would hold on to it as evidence that she was paid. So because this document is to her detriment, it's only for his benefit, she actually has to go to the sofer to request it being drafted, not her husband. So even though the husband is not there, she would request the shover, the receipt that she would give. And then the Mishnah adds a point, an interesting point, but it's not fundamental to our Mishnah. The only time that the sofer should be drafting these documents when only one party is present and not both parties, if he is familiar with both the husband and the wife, he knows their names, the witnesses there know their names. Otherwise, we're concerned that just he is going to come and have a get written, she's going to come by herself unilaterally and have a shover written, and then they would use it for improper purposes. You don't want those documents being floated around and having other people getting a hold of them and using it for other purposes. V'habaal notsen sachar. And in this situation, for the writing of the get and the shovar, it would be the husband who has to pay the costs, the legal expenses, that would be the payment to the sofer. He has to pay for the get itself because it's his responsibility to prepare the get and to deliver it to his wife. And also, he has to pay for the shovar, even though we'd be requesting it from the sofer, but it's because it was written for his benefit, evidencing that he had paid her the ksuba, so she doesn't come and recollect the second, third, and fourth times. The Mishnah now continues in the discussion of a loan document. Who has to go and request the drafting of a loan document? If both parties, both the lender and the borrower, are not going to go together, who has to request it? So the Mishnah says, Kosvin shtar lelove Af al pishein malva imo, the lova, the borrower can go and request from the sofer the drafting of the loan document, even though the lender is not there. Why? Because this document, which evidences a debt owed, is to the detriment of the lova, the borrower. So we have to have the detrimented party go and request that it be drafted. Vein kosvin la malva ad shiyehe lova imo. We can't, the sofer cannot draft it on behalf of the malva, the lender, unless the lova is there, because the lover has to say, yes, I am entering into this and I am accepting upon myself this debt. So we need the lova to be there, because he is the person that it's going to be to his detriment, that document. V'halova nos en sachar, but when it comes to the payment, it's going to be the borrower who is going to pay, because the loan is being given for his benefit, so he's going to have to be the one that pays. And interestingly, in many commercial contexts, so too when there are borrowers and lenders, oftentimes it is the borrower, just like in our Mishnah, that has to pay for the legal fees of the lender. We see that in big commercial transactions. You see that in investment banking. An investment bank is working on behalf of the client. It's going to be the client that's benefiting from the deal, from the loan, whatever financing is happening. They would bear all of the legal expenses. Third scenario in our Mishnah is when somebody approaches a sofer to have a bill of sale drafted. And who has to request that? If you have something evidencing a sale of an asset, kosvin shtar lemocher af al pi she'ein lokeach imo, he will be the seller that has to request it, because the item is being taken from him. It can't be vein kosvin lelokeach. It can't be that the purchaser is going to simply go and request the drafting of the bill of sale from the sofer ad shiyehe mocher imo. It has to be that the seller who's going to be losing the asset, he's selling the asset, he has to be the one that is there. Either they're both there together, or the mocher himself can request the sofer, the scribe, to write the bill of sale. V'halokeach nos en sachar, and in this situation, the purchaser would have to pay the legal fees. He is considered the one who benefits more from the sale, and the mocher is viewed as more to his detriment in selling an asset. In Mishnah Dalet, we have various scenarios where both people that need a document are required to be present while requesting it from the sofer, in contrast to the prior Mishnah that only one of the parties needed to be present. The Mishnah says as follows. We're going to go through three different situations. Ein kosvin shitrei erusin v'nesuin elamidas shneihem, where the sofer will only write a shtar erusin, which are the tanaim, which are the what we typically call tanaim nowadays, where the both sides at the erusin, at the engagement before the nesuin, which used to be much more in advance, they would make financial commitments back and forth. The nesuin and also the writing of the ksuba elamidas shneihem, both sides, the groom and the bride, but really the fathers of each of them, they have to be present in the writing of those shtaros by the sofer, and because they're making mutual commitments back and forth, so both of them need to be present. V'achasan nosen sachar, and here the chasan side would pay the legal expenses, the expenses of the sofer, because he's viewed as the more primary beneficiary because he is receiving a dowry. Next situation that the Mishnah discusses, that both parties have to be present, in kosvin shitrei arisos v'kablonos. Ella midashneim, and our resources, these are transactions between parties, between, wouldn't say partners. If there's a landowner and somebody wants to rent out his land, and our resource is somebody who would pay a percentage of the yield of the field, and a kablan, when it says kablanus in the Mishnah, the kablan is one who doesn't pay a percentage of the yield, but pays a set fee per year. So these are the contracts that the landlord and the sharecroppers are entering into. They both, elamidashneim, they both parties have to be present in front of the sofer in order to request that he writes the document, and for him to write the document, v'makabel nosen sachar, and the recipient, in other words, not the landlord, but the aris or the kablan, the sharecropper, is the one who pays the schar, has to pay the legal fees, because he is viewed more as the beneficiary. And third situation in our Mishnah, in kosvin shitrei beirurin, the sofer would not write a shtar beirurin. There are different explanations what this means. It could be an arbitration agreement when going to Beis Din. Borurus is when one party party chooses one dayan, and the second party chooses a second dayan, and both of those dayanim will appoint a third dayan. So it's the agreement between the parties, or their other explanations, which we'll discuss in a little bit. V'chol ma'asa beis din ela midas shneihem, and also any verdicts of the beis din, it would only be written with the consent of both of the parties present. Ushnehem nosnim scharim, because this is to the liability for either party, could be the benefit for either party, they each have to share in the expenses of writing these documents. Now, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, he has a different view when it comes to the Shtar Beirurin. Shtar Beirurin, we explain, is an arbitration document, but it could also be explained as a document that has the claims of the different parties against each other, and the defendant or the plaintiff, if that's what we will call them, or the two parties litigating, they may have different claims. They will have different claims against each other, and they may not want the other party to see those claims. So Shneim Kosvim Shneim. So Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, is we write different documents for both parties. Even if it's a Shtar Beirurin, even if it's the same document for both of them, they're both appointing an arbitration panel for both sides. Nonetheless, the Gemara explains that because these sides aren't on the best of terms, if one needs to refer to the document, he's not going to have to go to the other person in possession of the document. So Shneim Kosvim Shneim, when in the litigation context, we would write separate documents for each, lazel la'atzmo v'lazel la'atzmo, one for one and one for the other, one for the defendant, one for the plaintiff, one for each of the litigants, then they would bear their own costs. Mishnah Hay, and subsequently a Mishnah Vav, we're going to continue discussing the laws of shtaros, the laws of documents, and we're going to discuss in both of these Mishnayas, if somebody had a loan outstanding, lender gave to a borrower a loan, and there was a partial repayment of the loan. How do we evidence that partial repayment so the lender doesn't come and recollect the amount that he has been paid? So we're going to have a couple of options in Mishnah Hey, we're going to talk about one, and then the second part of Mishnah Vav, we're going to talk about some other options to evidence a partial repayment of a loan. So in our Mishnah Hey, it says as follows, Mishapara Miktas Chovo. Here we have a borrower, he repaid a portion of the loan, but not the full amount. He took a loan for 100 and he repaid 20. How do we evidence that? So in this situation, instead of taking the normal route of the lender writing what would be a shovar, a receipt, and giving that to the lova saying, I got paid back 20, they decided to do a different structure, and they said, you know, let's go going forward, let's give the document to a third-party administrator, v'hishlis et shtaro. So that both of them, they decided, let's give to this third party, he'll administer the loan. He knows that 20 was repaid, even though the shtar says 100 is outstanding, only 80 is outstanding. And in this situation, the malva definitely wanted to get paid. I want some surety that I'm going to get paid. And the lova, the borrower, says, "Va'amar lo im lo nasati lach mikan va'ad yom ploni, I am so certain that I'm going to pay you on time that if I don't pay you by X date, 10 lo shtaro." Here, the borrower says to that third-party administrator, I'm so convinced, if I don't repay the balance of the loan, the 80, by a certain date, you can return the entire document, that loan document, to the lender, evidencing 100 outstanding, and he can collect that entire amount. In other words, the borrower here is saying, if I haven't paid on time, that 20 that I repaid is going to be a gift that I gave back to the lender, and he can collect the full 100 from me. What happens then? Higia hazman v'lo nasan. If that due date comes, and that borrower still did not repay that 80, what happens then? So Rabbi Yossi Omer Yitan, in that situation, that third-party administrator indeed will follow the instructions that he received from the borrower and will give the loan document back to the lender, and it evidences 100 that's outstanding, and that lender can collect the full 100. Rabbi Yossi of the view and the concept here is that something when is called an asmachta, a conditional commitment. An asmachta, according to Rabbi Yossi, even though it was a conditional commitment, when the borrower said, I'm so convinced that I'm going to pay back that X, because even though he was certain, but because he didn't actually accomplish what he committed to, the condition came true. The condition, if I don't give, we have to fulfill the end result of giving that document back, even though that borrower really did not believe that he would never repay. So Rabbi Yossi Omer Yitan, he has to give, that third party gives the lender the document back. Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Lo Yitan, he shouldn't give it back. And here Rabbi Yehuda is of the view that an asmachta is lo kanya. When you have a conditional commitment as this, the condition is, if I don't pay, then give the document. And when the person made that condition, he did not believe that condition would come true. There was no way it would come true because he was so certain that he would pay the money back on time. In such a situation, that is not a binding commitment because he wasn't really serious about the condition. And therefore, Rabbi Yehuda's of the view, you don't give back that document, asmachta lo kanya, conditional commitment, when you don't think the condition, when you're certain the condition is not going to come true, is not binding. And therefore, the third party would not give that loan document back to the lender. He would not be able to collect the full 100, only the 80. In Mishnah Vav, we deal with two situations of replacements or exchanges of an original document. In the Seifa, it's going to talk specifically about a continuation of Mishnah Hay. If there is a partial repayment of a loan, can that loan agreement be replaced with the lower new value? So the Reisha says as follows, Mishin Nimchak Starchovo, somebody had a Starchov, for example, a lender has a loan document that he's owed X amount by the borrower, he's owed 100 in our example, and what happens is that loan document is erased. It's the ink falls on it, it's submerged in water, whatever it may be, rain got on it. We have to replace it in order for the lender to be able to collect from that borrower. So how do we do that? So me'idin alav edim, edim come, and these are edim, witnesses that knew the substance of the original loan agreement, ubalifnei beisin, and they come and testify in front of beisin, va'osim lo kiyum, and we will make a replacement shtar. It's either the basting that's going to write the replacement, or it's going to be the adim that write it in front of the basting, and they write as follows: Ish ploni ben ploni, this lender nimchak shtaro, his starchov, his loan agreement, his IOU was erased. Beyond ploni, it happened on this day. Uploni uploni adav, and in the original loan document, the two witnesses were X, Y, and Z, and they recreate the document. They write the facts of the document that he lent 100 and has to be repaid by X date. And that's how we're protecting the lender to make sure that he can get repaid. And the safe of the Mishnah talks about somebody who made a partial payment. The borrower made a partial repayment on a loan. So what do we do to make sure that the lender does not recollect those amounts that have been repaid? Misha para miktas chovo. Here we have the borrower. He repaid the 20 of the 100 outstanding loan. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Yachlev, what we do is the original loan agreement. We can't leave the lender with the loan agreement that evidences that there is a loan of 100 outstanding. And we also don't return that to the borrower because he only paid 20, not the full 100. So what we should do, says Rabbi Yehuda, is rewrite the loan agreement evidencing 80 outstanding, not 100. Rabbi Yossi Omer, I have a different solution. Yichtov Shovar. Simply have the lender write a receipt to the borrower evidencing a repayment of 20. This is a situation where the lender and the borrower, didn't want to hire a third party administrator, as we talked about in Mishnah. Hey, so here we have a different solution for them. Amar Rabbi Yehuda. Here Rabbi Yehuda says the problem, Rabbi Yossi, you want to simply write a receipt that the borrower is going to have to hold on to. Zet Sarich Lios Shomer Shovaro Minach Barim. That is going to put an onus on the borrower. He's going to have to make sure that he doesn't lose that receipt. It can be eaten by a mouse. It can be destroyed. It can be whatever. He can lose it. So Amar Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi says back to Rabbi Yehuda, that's actually a beneficial thing, that the borrower will feel pressure that he not lose the receipt, because that will inspire him. It will inspire that borrower. It's good for the lender because that borrower feel pressure to repay the loan even sooner. So that's a beneficial situation. Let that borrower feel pressure for the need to hold on to the receipts, and that will push him to repay the loan earlier, which is something the lender would want. And in addition, the lo yura kolcho shelza. In addition, another benefit is if we would have to rewrite the loan agreement, as you want to say, that is to the detriment of the lender, because we would be writing the new date of the agreement when that partial payment is made, and that's to the detriment of the lender. Why? Because there's a concept that if somebody gives a loan, he can collect on the assets of the borrower even if those assets are sold, as long as they were sold after the date of the loan. and he was unable to collect from the borrower, that lender can go and collect from a third party that purchased those assets, because that lender has a shibud. He has effectively has a mortgage on those. He has a security interest in those assets. So if you're going to rewrite the loan document with a new date, he's not going to be able to go and collect from those assets that were sold between the date of the original loan and the restatement of that loan, the new document when it was written. Now, Lemaisa, in the Gemara, it says that we paskin like Rav Kuna in the name of Rav. We paskin like neither Rav Yehuda or Rav Yossi. Rather, what a Beis Din would do is if you have a partial repayment on the loan, they would take the original loan document, the Beis Din, they would tear it up, and they would rewrite a new loan agreement, but they would use the original date of the original loan. So they would rewrite a loan agreement. Instead of the 100, it'd be 80, but they date it the same date as the original loan agreement, so that would not be to the detriment of the lender, that it would have a later date on the loan document. In Mishnah Zayin, we continue a concept that we touched on in Mishnah Vav. Mishnah Vav, the concept was that somebody did not have the funds in order to pay back a loan, so he had to pay back only partially. So Mishnah Zayin continues with someone who doesn't have proper funding. So it says as follows, Shnei Achim, if we have two brothers, Echad Ani Vechad Ashir, one who is not well off, he is poor, and one who is wealthy, and they receive an inheritance from their father, they receive certain assets from their father. As the examples in the Mishnah are a merchatz, a bathhouse, or a beis habad, or a beis habad. It could be both or either, which is an olive press. These are items that can be used either for personal use, or they can be rented out, and they can be used to earn profit. So asa on the sachar. The Mishnah is about to tell us that the brothers would continue the use that the father used it. So asa on the sachar, if the father used one or both of these assets in order to make a profit, hasachar le'em. So one brother cannot say, I'm going to use it for personal use. Rather, they would be required to continue using it for the same purpose the father used it, and they would have to split the profits from the assets. Asa an the atzman. However, if the father used those assets, he used the shvitz, the wash house, or he used the olive press for his own purpose, hare ha'ashir omelani, the wealthy brother can say to the poor brother, I know you may have no benefit in using it for yourself, but you're not permitted because of the use of our father. You're not permitted to go and rent it out to other people. So kachla chavadim, if you only had the assets, you should go and you should hire workers for you, and they can heat up the bathhouse, v'yurchatsu b'merchatz, and you could use it for your personal use to take a shvitz. Kachlach zeisim, if you had the assets, you can go and you can buy olives, ubova asem ebeisaban, and you can use the olive press for your own personal use, but you're not permitted to go and use it and rent it out elsewhere, because that wasn't the use that our father made of these assets. The Mishnah now gets back to the halachas of shtaros dealing with loan documents and discusses the strange and unique situation that you have two people living in the same city, and they have the same names, and their fathers have the same names, and there's going to be confusion. Who is the lender? Who is the borrower? Who owes who money? So we're going to talk about three specific scenarios. Shnayim shayu b'yirachas. There were two people. They lived in the same city. Shem Echad Yosef ben Shimon. One's name was Yosef ben Shimon. V'shem Acher had the same identical name, Yosef ben Shimon. And there's a loan document that says Yosef ben Shimon gave a loan to Yosef ben Shimon. Ein yecholim lahotzi shtarchov ze al ze. They are not able to collect one from the other, because the supposed borrower can claim that he was in fact not a borrower, but he was the lender. So you can't collect on such a loan document. Second situation, v'lo acher, and a third party cannot, yachol lehotzi aleihem shtarchov. A third party can also not collect, because it says in the loan document he gave a loan to Yosef ben Shimon, and it's unclear which Yosef Shimon it is. Maybe he's going to collect from the wrong one. Third scenario, nimtza le'echad ben shtarosav. Somebody found amongst his documents, he found in his file cabinet, and this was somebody who borrowed from a Yosef ben Shimon, shtarosho Yosef ben Shimon paru, and it says on a receipt that the loan that he took from Yosef ben Shimon has been paid, and in fact he took from loans from both Yosefs ben Shimons, and we don't know which one was repaid. So the Mishnah says, similar to before, shtarosh shneim paruim, the second Yosef ben Shimon indeed cannot collect anymore because we do not know whose is really the loan that is outstanding. So how do we solve this lechatchila if we have a situation? Two people have the identical names. Ketzad Yasu, what's a solution for this? So it's a simple solution. Yeshaleshu, instead of Rosh just writing his name and his father's name, because they're all identical, include the grandfather's name. And if the grandfather's name is identical, three generations of identical names, Yahayu Meshulashim, Yichtuv a Simon, write a Simon. In other words, I'm taking a loan from Yosef ben Shimon, the tall one, and not the short one, or whatever characteristic would be very significant in distinguishing the two of them. Vim Hayu Misumanim, what if they have similar physical characteristics? Yichtavu Kohen, write that one is a Kohen, one is a Levi, or find some other distinguishing factor to put in that loan document that could distinguish one Yosef Shimon from the second. The Mishnah now continues in a situation where there's a loan document which cannot be used to collect the loan because it's unclear whether it has been repaid or not. So Haomer, somebody who was a lender, and he's on his deathbed. Haomer Libno, and he says to his son, Shtar ben Shtorosai Parua, one of the loan documents that is amongst my documents has been repaid already, so you cannot collect from the borrower on that loan document. The problem is, Veina Yodea Ezehu, I don't remember right now which of those loans has been repaid. The father was on his deathbed, is concerned that the son will go and collect that loan, even though that borrower had relied on the father saying, I'm repaying you, we don't have to document it, I trust you. Now the father is on his deathbed, and the father is worried once that son collects on that loan, not knowing that what is already repaid, the father would be punished in Shamayim for letting that happen. So that's why the father says one of them has been repaid. I don't know which one. Veini Yodea Ezu, the Mishnah says, Shtaros Kulam Pruim. All of them have to be considered repaid because the son needs to make sure he doesn't go and collect on that one specifically. So he would not be able to collect on any of them. Now the Mishnah says that there's an exception to that. Nimtza le'achad sham shnayim. If among the loan documents, there is somebody who borrowed twice. So there are two loan documents, two loans to the same person. You can assume one of them for sure has not been repaid because the father only told his son a loan has been repaid. So if you have two loan documents, two loans to the same person, the Mishnah says, Hagadlo paru, you have to assume then that the more expensive one, the higher loan has been repaid. V'hakatan eino paru, you can assume that the smaller one has not been repaid and the son would be able to collect on that and only on that loan. The Mishnah now turns to a new topic and a very, very important and relevant topic, halacha lemaisa topic, in dealing with somebody who guarantees a loan. This is fairly common throughout the world to have guarantors on loan, but especially in Eretz Yisrael, there are guarantees not even just on loans. I was surprised about this, having moved to Israel from the United States. They even request guarantors, two guarantors, a minimum, on leases. That's very common, or somebody goes and gets a loan from a gemach. I understand that they'll even ask for up to 5, 6 or more guarantors. So this is a very common question. What happens if there is a default by the borrower? At what point can the lender go and collect the defaulted amount from the arev, from the guarantor? And we'll see in a little bit, there are actually two types of guarantors. One is the standard one, and one is called an arev kablan, who is more involved in the deal and instructs, requests the lender to lend to the borrower the amount. So he's going to have a higher liability when it comes to default. But we're going to start initially with the regular form of an arev, a guarantor on a loan. So the Mishnah says as follows, Hamalves chaveiro al yedei arev. Somebody gave a loan to a borrower and there was a guarantor. So the Mishnah says, lo yipara min ha'arev. You cannot collect from the guarantor. What does that mean? Until you've gone through the process of trying to collect from the borrower, you've gone to Beis Din finds in your favor, and still the borrower defaults, at that point, the lender can go and collect from the guarantor. Now, there's going to be a different situation. How about if the lender said up front, I don't want to have this headache headache of going to Beis Din and going through this whole legal process and then having a default by the borrower. I need it simple. I need to be able to collect the funds that I'm borrowing, and I should be able to go after whoever I want. If I want to go after the borrower, if I want to go after the guarantor, it's not up to me to have to run after the two of you. So it says, Vim Amar, if the lender said up front at the time of the loan or before the loan, Al Minas She'eh Pareh Mimi She'eretz, so I'm giving this loan on the condition that I can collect from whoever I want. It's got to be simple for me. Then the Mishnah says, Yipara Min Ha'arev. Then you can collect from the guarantor. You don't have to go through the Beis Din process. Now, the Gemara there, very important. Gemara makes a distinction. It says, B'medvarim Amurim. When are we talking about that he can go and collect from the Arev directly? K'she'ein Nechasim Lalova. I'm reading what's lacking in a Mishnah, and the Gemara says, this text is missing in our Mishnah. So, Chasuri Mechzer V'hachik. What are we talking about? When the borrower doesn't have assets, then the lender can go directly to the guarantor. However, if that lova, the borrower does have free assets that he could pay back, even when the stipulation was made by the lender that I should be able to go after whoever I want, nonetheless, as long as the borrower has assets to repay, he would be required to go to the borrower first before to go to the guarantor. Now, the Mishnah does, the Gemara then continues. Before we get back to the Mishnah, this was still text I was missing from our Mishnah. Now we make that distinction between the two types of guarantors. If you have the type of guarantor that's called the Kablan, it's a Kablan Arev, and in other words, that was the one who said, come to me, make a loan, and you don't have to go after the borrower at all. Just come directly to me, and I'll make the payment. So the Mishnah would say, that's the Gemara is imputing this to the Mishnah, in such a case also, the lender can go and collect from the Kablan, even if the borrower in that situation does have assets. In other words, the guarantor said, he's a Kablan, he says, come to me first, that's what the lender can do. Now, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, we're back in the Mishnah now. He disagrees even in that situation of a Kablan, an Arev Kablan, who says, come to me first, I'll repay you. He says, Im yesh nechasim lalov, even for this of Kablan, who has a higher level of liability, Bein kach, whether we're talking about a regular guarantor or we're talking about a Kablan guarantor who has higher liability, lo yipara min ha'arev, still the lender would not be able to collect from the guarantor. As long as there are assets for the borrower would be responsible to repay the loan. The final part of our Mishnah deals with another situation that Chazal instituted something for the benefit of an Arev, a guarantor. So here we're talking about somebody who guarantored the payment of a ksuba. For example, if a wife and husband get divorced and she has to collect the ksuba, if the husband would default, then the Arev would be on the hook. V'chein haya, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, Hey Arev li'isha b'ksuba sa, somebody who's a guarantor on the ksuba of a wife. The husband is divorcing her. Our concern that we see in a little bit is that maybe this is a conspiracy between the husband and wife, that the husband will default on the payment of the ksuba, the wife will go collect from the guarantor, and then they'll move off to Hawaii with the funds, not literally, but they'll take the funds from the guarantor, and then they'll simply get married. They conspired to bilk the guarantor out of the funds, and then they'll get remarried. So the Mishnah says, in order to avoid such a problem, Yadirena Hana'a, the husband must make a vow, a commitment, a vow continuing, everlasting, that she, the wife, or as she will be the ex-wife soon, will never have any benefit from him. So the effect of that is that they would never be able to get remarried. And the Mishnah now explains what we said before, Shema Yasu Kenunya on the Chasim Shalzeh. The concern is that this husband and wife, maybe they may conspire together to have the guarantor pay the ksuba amount to the wife, v'yachzir asishto, and he will simply get married to his wife again, and they will live with the amounts, the funds of the guarantor. So to avoid that problem, Chazal instituted for the protection of the Arev that the husband would have to make this vow that she would never be able to have enough from him, and accordingly they would not be able to get married, remarried. Mishnah Ches is the final Mishnah of Baba Basra and deals with something very critical. In particular, it deals with when a lender is trying to collect on a loan. what types of assets can he collect from? And we're going to divide up initially in the resha of the Mishnah, collecting from the borrower, and then the seifa, the latter part of the Mishnah, we're going to talk about when he tries to collect from a guarantor in Arev. And just by way of further introduction, we're going to divide up between two types of assets. Assets that are b'nei chorin, and the chasim b'nei chorin, which means that they are in the possession of either the borrower or the arev, whoever the lender is trying to collect from, he still owns those assets. And nechasim mishubadim are the types of assets that were owned by either the borrower or the arev at the time the loan was given, but were subsequently sold to a third party. And the issue that we're going to deal with is when can the lender collect from those assets that are now owed by a third party, but were owned by the borrower or the arev, the guarantor, at the time of the loan. So we're going to start out talking about when a lender tries to collect from a borrower, and here we're going to divide up the Mishnah into how the loan was actually given, because there's different strengths of the loan. So initially the Mishnah says as follows, Hamalva es chavero bishtar. If somebody gives a loan to somebody and it's recorded in a document and the document was signed by two witnesses, by two eidim, govim minachasim mishubadim. In that case, if the borrower does not have assets to himself, that lender can go and collect assets that were sold subsequent to the loan that are currently owned by third parties. Why? Because it was done in a proper and formal way. The loan was signed in an agreement and there were witnesses. That act acts effectively as giving public notice to those third-party purchasers that these assets, these fields were subject to a lien by the lender. So because they had notice of it, they purchased it, we impute notice to them that they knew that they were subject to a lien, so the lender can go and collect from those third-party purchasers. Al yedei eidim, however, scenario number two is if the loan was not written, it was just given in front of Eidim, that does not give effective notice to third-party purchasers, and accordingly, govim minachasim b'nei chorin, this lender can only collect from assets that are owned by the borrower. He cannot go and collect assets that were subsequently sold to those third-party purchasers because they didn't have notice that the assets were subject to a lien. Similarly, hotzi alav ksav yado. The lender pulls out a loan agreement and it's written in the handwriting of the borrower that says, I owe you X, Y, and Z. Is that strong enough or is that not strong enough for the lender to go and collect from third parties? It says, Shuchayev lo, I acknowledge, it's in his hand, I acknowledge, I owe you X, Y, Z. That's not up for dispute. Who can he collect from? Govim minachasim b'nei chorim. The lender can only collect from assets still owned by the borrower, cannot collect from third-party purchasers because that they did not have effective notice that the properties that they were buying were subject to a lien. The second part of the Mishnah, as I mentioned, now discusses the lender trying to collect from an arev, from a guarantor. And the Mishnah says as follows, arev, hayotze la'achar chitum shtaris. In our situation, the arev, the guarantor, did not sign on initially on the loan document before the signatories, before the witnesses signed that, the loan agreement, but rather he signed on afterward. And the result of that is that the signature of those eidim, of those witnesses, does not effectively give notice to third-party purchasers because the guarantor signed after they signed, not before. Arev ayotze la'achar chitum shtaro. So we have this guarantor that signed after the two witnesses. The lender now, govim minachasim b'nei chorim. He can only collect from assets that are owned by the RF. Still, he cannot collect from third parties who purchased the assets after the time of the loan. Now, we're going to see in the Mishnah that this was actually a dispute from between two Tanaim. This actually occurred. Ma'aseh ba'lifnei Rabbi Yishmael. This ma'aseh came before Rabbi Yishmael, ve'amar, and he paskin, just as we mentioned now, govim minachasim b'nei chorim. This lender can only collect from the guarantor, from assets still owned by the guarantor, not from third-party purchasers. Amar lo ben nanas, but nanas disagreed. He says as follows, eino govim lo minachasim meshubadim, ve'lo minachasim b'nei chorim. This lender cannot collect from this guarantor any type of assets, certainly not from third parties, but even assets owned by that arev, he cannot collect from then? So now Rabbi Yishmael asks him, Amar lo lama, why not? At least tell him he can collect from the assets that are owned by the Arev. You gave a guarantee on the loan. Amar lo, so Benana said, I'm going to give you a parallel. I'm going to give you an analogy. Hare hachonek es echad bashuk. Somebody is walking by, and he sees somebody strangling, literally strangling another in the shuk. But what it's talking about now is a creditor. And a creditor is actively, aggressively trying to collect from a borrower unsuccessfully. Umitzao chaveru, and the third party is walking by, and he sees him. This is the Arev, the guarantor of Amarlo. And this third party says to the collector, who's trying to collect on his loan, the lender, Hanachlo, leave this guy alone, I'll pay you. Leave him alone, stop strangling him. Stop aggressively trying to collect your loan. So after the fact, the lender lets the borrower off the hook. Does the Arev have to pay? Does the third party walking through the shuk have to pay? So the Mishnah says, Potter. He does not have to pay. And the rationale is, Shelo al emuna sohilvahu. Because initially, at the time that the loan was given, the lender did not give the loan based on trusting that the guarantor would come through. The guarantor wasn't involved at that time. And interestingly, if we put this into commercial legal language nowadays, there's a concept that for a contract to be binding, there needs to be consideration. A consideration means it's not the type of consideration, be nice to people, but consideration means that there needs to be a benefit that's bargained for on both sides. Both of the parties need to give and take, and each needs to be giving and taking. So we would say in this situation that an Arev comes afterward and says, I'll pay, there's no consideration. He's getting nothing in return. There's no consideration. He's only giving and not getting. So Benanas continues and says, so when would an Arev have to pay Ela'ezu Arev Shuchayev? When do we have that situation? The situation is Pashut. Halvehu the Ani no sen lach, when initially the loan is being given and the Arev is involved, and it's the loan is given based on the understanding that the Arev is there to guarantee the loan, and if there is a default by the borrower, then the Arev will pay. Halvehu v'ani no sen lach, I will act in his replace, I'll pay you if there's a default. Chayev, in that case, the Arev is responsible. Because in that situation, it was because of the trust that the lender had in the Arev, in the guarantor, because he knew he could rely on his repayment, that on that case, if there's a default by the borrower, then that Arev indeed has to pay. But in the situation that the Arev became involved after the fact, according to Ben Nanas, he would not have to pay. Now, interestingly, we do paskin like Rabbi Yishmael, that the Arev who comes afterward, he does have to pay, but only if there is a kinyan. Now, despite that we paskin like Rabbi Yishmael, here we have Rabbi Yishmael go and praise Ben Nanas and the wise input and the distinctions in the halacha that Ben Nanas gave in understanding his viewpoint. And Amar Rabbi Yishmael, harota sheya, anyone who wants to be wise, yasok bedine mamono, should go and study in the Torah, should study the financial manners, monetary manners in the Torah, choshen mishpat, shein lach mikzoa betorah gadol mehen, because there's no greater area in the Torah that is like choshen mishpat, like monetary manners, shein kema'ayan hanoveh, because it is like a flowing stream that gets stronger and stronger. And continues Rabbi Yishmael in praise of Ben Nanas, varotzeh sheyasok bedine mamonos, if anyone wants to really study well Dine Mamonos, monetary matters in the Torah, Yeshamesh as Shimon Benanas, he should go and learn from Shimon Benanas, because he was so erudite and wise in his understanding of financial matters. Mazel Tov in the completion of Maseches Baba Basra.